Well, not dumb things, maybe crazy things. I really like that song. Not just because it's got like sort of bit of nostalgic sort of old groove to it, but what it actually says. It is describing a crazy kind of love. You could say it's describing a very sentimental, maybe even like obsessive love. A love, well, think of these words. Just have a look up on screen. These are the first words. When a man loves a woman, can't keep his mind on nothing else. he'll trade the world for the good thing he's found. You know, so it's, you know, the idea that you've found this good thing, you found this lady, and you'd trade everything to be able to have her, to be able to hold her, to be able to have her love. It goes on to say, when a man loves a woman, spend his very last dime. Yeah, who's done that? Oh, no one? Oh, man, you should have. And I remember that, like, saving up the dollars to buy the engagement ring. Do you remember that? Yeah. Trying to hold on to what he needs. It's interesting, this idea that when a man loves a woman, suddenly he finds that's what he needs. He so needs her that he'll pay whatever it costs to have her. He'd give up all his comfort, sleep out in the rain, if she said that's the way it ought to be. I mean, there's sort of a weird side to that later on. It's like, oh, she said it, so we'll better do it kind of thing. But in the early days of love, it's like, man, if she asks it, I'll go sleep out in the rain. If she says, oh, I really think it'd be a good idea for you to go and sleep in the rain. Okay, anything, yeah, okay. Like all night? Yeah, okay. You know, it's like just what maybe love would drive us to. It's interesting, towards the end of the song, there's a little refrain that in later editions has been dropped, which I think's a bit sad. It says this at the end. When a man loves a woman, he can do no wrong. It's not meaning he can't do anything wrong. It's like he can do no wrong when it comes to her. He can never own some other girl. It's interesting that that's like not in more later editions of the song, isn't it? But I think it's beautiful. It's like going, man, when you love this girl, she's your one and only. You can't own another. She's the only one for you. Love can make us really singularly focused. Some would say that can be a bad thing. It's like can be this unhealthy obsession. But what if the one that you love is so perfect that would demand your single focused obsession? Or what if the one who's loving, that their love is so perfect that it can be single focused? Some would say that really this kind of love that the song is describing is like a blind love. You know, love is blind. I like to think of it this way. It's more like love that is a healthy love but with a single focus is more like love with blinkers on. I don't know if you remember, it's even modern today, but in the old days they would have the horses, and I can remember Dad having all this gear in the shed from his bygone era when they used to not have machinery on the farm and they just had the horses on the farm, and so there were all the different pack saddles and yokes for around the Clydesdale horses, and one of the things was these funny sort of bridles that had the leather, you know, pieces that sat here, the blinkers. And even today, you still have them, like on a racehorse, they'll still have a form of the blinkers. And the idea with the blinkers is to help have single focus and not be distracted, you know, and have your attention divided by what's off to the sides, off to the peripheries. It's the idea to be focused in front. And so the idea on with the horses is that the person either on the carriage or walking behind and working the stock horses, or even the jockey on the racehorse, is controlling the turn of the head with the bridle. And the blinkers are enabling the rider, the driver, to actually decide what the horse will look at. And so it's not suddenly distracted by what's over to the left or what's over to the right. It's a blinker approach. It's not blind, but very focused. And I wonder if this is actually the kind of love, in a way, that when we come to this idea of loving one God, it's not a blind love, but it's a very single-focused love. It's a love with blinkers on. When we think of this idea of loving one and only, love one God, or it might be that when a man loves a woman, she becomes his one and only. Does that mean that love, in essence, has to always be single-focused? Is it possible to multiply that kind of love out to others, or is that really not realistic? Because as soon as we do that, we corrupt or water down or distract from the love that's first. So when we're called, for example, to love one God, does that mean, in fact, that we can't love anyone or anything else? What does it mean to only love one God? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul and your mind. It can't actually mean that we only are to love God, because God calls us to love each other. God calls us to love our enemies. God calls us to love our wives. God calls us to love our neighbors. But God also says, you cannot love me and love money. You'll love one and hate the other. You can only serve one. So in some ways, God's saying, I've got to be your one and only. But he's also saying, I want you to love everybody. So which is it? What does it mean to love him? I think when we're called to love one God, it's a call to be blind to all else. Sorry, it's a call not to be blind to all else, but more like choosing to have blinkers on so that we are focused on what he is focused on. It's as if in this life, God would be the one that would put the blinkers on us and he would take the reins, and we would say, we are quite happy, God, for you to direct our head as to where our attention would be. God, our love for you is first. And as you would direct our attention to love, you would show us who or what to love. You would be the one that would be in control. Now, the idea of love, of control, of God controlling what we love and who we love, sounds very restrictive. In fact, today we're going to talk about commandments, for example. And as soon as we get this idea that we are even called to follow the greatest commandment to love God, it doesn't seem to fit with our culture, does it? Like, so God's saying, there's a rule I want you to keep. It's a number one rule. It says, you have to love me. Like, and we go, that's not what love is. Like, how can love be rule-keeping? Isn't love something that's free of the heart? Isn't love something that you choose? Like, if somebody comes to you and they say, well, actually, I've decided, see this person over here? That's going to be your one and only. You have to love them. It just goes, doesn't it cut right against the grain of us? It's like, well, you can't tell me who to love. I don't feel anything for them. I don't even know them. And if I did, maybe I don't even like them. So how do we love under this sort of like what seems to be like a controlled environment? What does that even mean? Well, I think of it a little bit like this thing of loving. The fact that we need to love. When I met Lorraine, I mean, that was like, not as if like somebody said, see that girl, you have to love her. Like, they didn't say that to me. Her uncle did say to me, my niece is going to be at this Bible school, and when you get there, look after her. And I said, yes. So in a way, I was being obedient to a command. So I rocked up, and I met Lorraine, and we fell in love. And I chose, free choice, I chose to, like, you know, to love Lorraine, and she chose to love me. And looking back, we can see that in a way God chose us for each other. In my love for Lorraine, there comes a point where I choose for her to be my one and only love. Love is free, right? Love is freedom. Love is a free choice. But when love, I think, is real, love will often choose to be yes to some things and no to others, which at that point sounds very controlling and restrictive. So when I choose to be yes to Lorraine, suddenly I choose to be no to a whole lot of others. And it's not as if in that moment I suddenly go, oh man, I just lost control. I want to be free to love. I don't feel like that. I feel like it's I am free now because I've found somebody that I love to give my love and affection to and to give my life up for the good of the other. And as a result of that, it doesn't feel restricted to then go, oh, man, this is stink. I can't love all these other girls. Oh, I just lost my freedom. Really? Like, what is love? Like, love to me is about this word, yes. Love is not about no to a bunch of other girls. In this case, love for me is about yes to Lorraine. It's a choice, it's freedom. But I choose to put the blinkers on. I choose to have focus. I choose to have a one and only. It's a little bit what Job says. Job talks about this, and he says that he's made a covenant with his eyes, you know, not to look at other women. What is that about? Like Job's saying, man, I've got my one and only. I love her. I've made a covenant with God that I'm going to put my blinkers on and I'm not going to look at any other girls because I want to look at this girl only. That's what he's saying. And you go, a covenant? And he's made a rule for his life? What a restrictive, controlled kind of life that is. But I don't think that's what Job's saying. He's like, I'm free. I'm free to love my one and only, and I'm no to all the rest because I love this one. I love this one. So when I chose to love Lorraine, didn't really choose, it sort of just like, you know, she tricked me or something, or stole my heart. When I did that, that didn't mean then that for my life she's the only one that I love. So it's not in the sense so single focused that because I've decided and chosen to love Lorraine that she's my one and only, the only one I love. But my love for her is in a unique way a one and only love. So it's not as if, like, you go, so can that love be multiplied out? Well, yes and no. Like, yes in that, so we have our boys. We have four boys, and it's like, sorry, boys, can't love you. Mum's my one and only. It's like, you know, I love my boys. And then I've got neighbours, Gary and Anne-Marie. I love Gary and Anne-Marie. It's like I can't go to my neighbours and go, sorry, guys. Can't be kind and helpful to you guys today because Lorraine's my one and only. Like, it doesn't make sense, does it? We can love many people, but there is a uniqueness to the relationship of a husband and a wife. It's a one and only relationship. And isn't it obvious that there are some ways in which I love Lorraine that I am not free to love another with that kind of love? There's a physical, emotional intimacy that we have in our chosen relationship of love that is not to be shared with anyone else. It's one and only love. It's like putting the blinkers on, and in this case, it might be going, I mean, it's really going Holy Spirit, but it could be like Lorraine, you've got the reins, like I'm only, you know, it's not quite that's bad illustration. But anyway, it's to have my eyes fixed on her alone when it comes to that relationship. Now, I'd say like in human relationships, that is my number one relationship. I've said this to the boys. I don't think Lorraine says it because she's got like even love for everybody in our family. But for me, I've said to our boys that sometimes I've said, Mum's one and only. She's first. Lorraine's first. Sounds horrible. I've actually said this to a couple of my sons. I've said, I love Lorraine more than you. I've said that, which sounds real mean. But what I've tried to get them to understand is that she is my first, but that doesn't mean I love you less, really. It's that, but she's first. And I think that's the uniqueness of love sometimes. See, before Lorraine, really, in the order of things, my mum and dad should be first, and they were. Like, I loved my mum and dad. They were first. That's why it was said, and for this reason, a man will leave his mother and father and be joined to his wife, and they become one. See, the order just changed. So it went from mum and dad, you're my first, love you, and then it's like, in a human relationship, it's like, sorry guys, you're not first anymore. Lorraine's first. So let's bring this to love one God. We come to understand and know the love of God for us. And there's a great freedom we have at that moment. We're free. We're not controlled. We're completely free to respond to his love. And when we choose to love him, to respond to his love for us, he becomes our one and only in a unique way. Doesn't mean we can't love others. We certainly can. But we're never to love others in the way that we're to love him. He has to become first. He has to become first. We have to love him uniquely. And you go, well, how do we do that? And I know, like, in the series we've been looking at these ideas. We're to love him heart and soul. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Just flick on to the things. Just where it says heart and soul. Cool. To love God with all your heart and soul is to choose to give all of myself to God and for the good of God continually. That's been our idea, to love heart and soul. And mainly over the series and in our life groups and through your Sacred Pathways guides, we've been exploring this idea that love needs to be expressed. Express yourself. This love, this giving of myself to God needs to find expression. And so we're looking at these different ways that we might express. You might be the intellectual who needs to really think deeply about the things of God and study that. You might be the contemplative who's more like in love with God and just needing to chill out and sing him love songs. You might be the naturalist who needs to find a mountaintop to go and be with God there. And you know what? That's good, and it's important, and it's part of the journey that we're on as a church, is exploring our diversity and the different ways that we express our love to God. It's good. It's not what's most important. It's not, those things are not the primary expression of our love for God. If God is our one and only, if he is first, because he's our creator, but also the one who loves us most and has given his life for us, and if we've come to that point of recognizing his love and saying, God, I want to be yes to you. I love you. If he would say, here's the greatest thing you can do, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. You're going, that's it. I want to love you, God, my creator, my maker, the one who gave your life for me. Then this is the greatest expression of our love, is being yes to him. The greatest expression of our love for God is choosing to be yes for him. It's as if that idea of saying, God, I'm going to put the blinkers on. I want you, God, by your Holy Spirit and with your word, to be the one that turns my head. I don't want to look or pursue anything unless it's what you want me to look and pursue. I am yes to you. But I want to say this, that when you are yes to something, you are no to something. When I'm yes to Lorraine, I have to be no to others. As far as that relationship goes, that unique relationship. When I decide that I'm going to be yes to God, I'm going to be no to other things. You can't, that's why he says, you can't love me and love money. You can't be divided like that. You're going to have to choose one. You're going to have to serve one. You can't have both. You say, why do I say this is the primary expression? Like, what? Surely when we come and we sing our praises to him, or when I kneel and surrender and cry out in prayer to him, or when I'm on a mountaintop being still in his presence, like, surely those things are great expressions, and they are, but they are not the primary expression of our love for God. Whether you want to go Old Testament or New, whether you want to go into the law or into grace, whether you go the words of Moses or the words of Jesus, repeated over and over again, when we are called to love God, there is always an expression alongside it. And the expression is this: we must be yes to God. Like look at Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. This is where this, what Jesus later quotes as the greatest commandment is found. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. So remember, we talked about this idea of loving God from deep within to all of our being is to love him, to give ourselves to him continually. Look at verse 6. Straight away, these commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. See, straight away, this idea, love God. And we go, yeah, I so love you, Jesus. And he's going, loving God, what does that look like? My commandments, what I want from you and what I want you to be towards and focused on and how I want you to live and who I want you to be, my commandments, I want them to be on your heart. It's good to have great feelings towards God, but he doesn't go into that here. Moses is saying, man, to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind is you have his words on your heart. And then he says this, impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. He's just saying, let your whole life be surrounded and constantly in front of your eyes with your blinkers on, my words, be yes to me. Look at Deuteronomy 11 and verse 1. It says a similar thing, just condenses it down. 11 and 1, love the Lord your God and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws and his commands always. You can't pull these two things apart. You cannot pull obedience and love apart. You can't go, oh, I so love you, God, but man, I'm not doing that. I so love you, God, but I'm holding on to this. You can't take that away from me. You cannot be no to God and love God. To be loving God is to be yes to God. And if you go, that's just the law. That's just Moses. Like he was just, God was cranky that day. It's not that. Look at John 14. This is Jesus. And the occasion of this is significant. He's 3 years been with these close friends, his disciples, with the 12. And he's about to be betrayed and to be arrested and to be tortured and then to be crucified. And knowing all of that, John tells us he loves his disciples to the end and he sits with them and he wants to impart to them his final words. You think these are his final words. This is what really counts. These words of Jesus, it's like everybody should be leaning on in going, what have you got to tell us, Jesus, before you leave the planet? Like, what are your final words? And listen to these kind of words. John 14, 15. If you love me, you can imagine the disciples like, yeah, we do. We love you, Jesus. We've been following you for 3 years. You are the man and you do amazing things and you're so patient with us and kind and we love you. What does he say? If you love me, keep my commands. Keep my commands. Verse 21, whoever has my commands and keeps them is the one who loves me. Imagine that. That's almost like slightly reversed there. Do you see that? Verse 15, if you love me, you follow my commands. Hey, from my perspective as I look out, and I see you keeping my commands, I know there's someone who loves me. The one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and show myself to them. Verse 23, Jesus replied, anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. This is about relationship. This is not about rule keeping. This is about a relationship that says, I so love you that I'm going to be yes to you. I'm going to be yes to you. Like we have relationships like that where we so love somebody, we're yes to them. It's like, I'm like that with Lorraine, with the boys. It's like, I so love them that I want to be yes to them. It's not like I'm, it's that love where you go, though you want this and that's going to mean me sleeping out in the rain, I'll do that because you want that. And here Jesus is saying, well, if you love me, won't you be yes to me? Look at verse 28. You heard me say, I'm going away and I'm coming back to you. If you loved me, you would be glad that I'm going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I. I was looking at that the other day, I was thinking, does that even fit? Like it's a if you loved me sort of sentence. What does that mean? You heard me say, I'm going away and I'm coming back to you. Now, the thing that they're really hearing is the going away part. They're grieving that. The reason that they're not glad, he's saying you should be glad. The reason that they're not glad is because he's going away. They are grieved by that. He says that if they truly love him, they would be glad because he's going to the Father and the Father is greater. You go, what does that mean? Jesus is saying, here's my Father. He's the greatest. And I love him and I want you to love him with all your heart, soul, mind and strength. You should love the Father like I love the Father. He's greatest. I'm going to the Father. You should be glad because I'm yes to the Father. And you're sad right now because all you're worried about is yourself and that you're going to miss seeing me. If you truly loved me, you would be excited that we, Jesus and you guys, are being yes to the Father. Because he's greater. It's like Jesus is leading the example of what love looks like. Go to chapter 15, verse 18. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as your own. As its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you also. You go, what's that got to do with love? What he's saying there is that when you are yes to me, you are no to some things. And that's going to cause conflict. When decisions come your way and you have to make that free choice, but you choose to be yes to me because you love me, that's going to put you at enmity with the world. Just like I am. Because in that moment when you say yes to me, you take a side. You take a side from the corruption and evil of this world and of the evil one, and you enter a battle because you've been yes to me. Look at chapter 16, verse 33. Even in the conflict, even in the persecution, even in the trouble that we might find ourselves in because we're yes to Jesus. Like recently, we've heard that, haven't we? That people have been yes to Jesus and just in the last week lost their lives because they've been yes to Jesus. He says this in verse 33, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. Why? Because we need to be no to some things. But take heart, I've overcome the world. So you go, what does yes to God look like? What does it look like? I mean, we can go to examples. We can go to like Daniel, you know, the Daniel who ended up in the lion's den. Well, before that, Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they end up in a foreign land and they get this great opportunity to go into the special school and maybe become somebody important in the kingdom of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar is looking for new recruits. And so they've got this great opportunity to do really well and get positions of power, but to do so would be compromised because the food that they have to eat was something that God had forbidden them to eat. And so they go, we are no to the food because we are yes to God. And you need to read the story to find out what happens next. Another part of their story later on is that they three of the guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, get called with all the people to bow down to this huge statue, and they go, we can't do that because we love God. We choose to be yes to God, so we're going to be no, King Nebuchadnezzar, to your rule in this area and to this statue, and so they are no. And so he gets really angry with them, and he says, because of that, I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace. Now, listen to their words at that point. They say these words. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. So that sounds cool. They're just going, bring it on, fiery furnace. We are yes to God. We are no to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, because he's going to save us. You go, that's cool. That's pretty bold. But listen to this, verse 18. Because when a man loves a woman, he'll go and sleep in the rain if she asks him to. When man loves one God, he'll go to the fiery furnace if that's what's required. And this is their words. But even if God does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. I mean, we know the outcome of the story. They didn't die in the furnace. God saved them. They did not know that. They had no idea of that. There was like, they hoped that, but they didn't have the end of the story. They're going before the king and they're saying, sorry, king, we are no to you because we are yes to God. And even if we have to lay our lives down in the furnace, we'll do that because we love God. What does love look like? What does being yes to God look like? It looks like Mary, this young girl, and she gets this freaky angelic visit, you know, saying, Mary, you're going to have a son. Imagine all the stuff in her head, all the confusion, all the fear of what people would think for her out of wedlock to have a baby. And what's her response? Look at her yes. I am the Lord's servant. May your word be fulfilled in me. She's yes to God. You see it. You go, does Mary love God? Of course she loves God. You can see it. But the greatest example is Jesus, isn't it? Like, you look at Jesus, there comes this night following all this love talk, you know? I mean, it's all good, Jesus. You talk it up. You tell us that we all should be yes to God. But then Jesus goes out and he says, and this is what it looks like. He goes out and he takes his friends with him and they go out into the garden. And there is, he's in this dark place and there's the shadows of the olive trees, and it's a night like no other night, because Jesus knows what's before him. And he kneels down on the ground, and as it were, his hands are probably gripping that rugged soil. And it's as if his whole body is just shaking and aching. It talks about him being in agony of soul. And as he trembles there, and as he sweats, what the writer says is like drops of blood. He knows what's before him. He knows that the Father in heaven has said, Son, will you go give your life for these people who are far from us, so that they might know our love and that they might come close? And the Son's there. Jesus is there and he's gripping the soil and he's sweating drops of blood and he's shaking as he trembles in agony. And these are his words. Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. There's a little bit of a surprise there, because you expect Jesus to be like, yeah, I'll do it. This is real. Jesus is going, Father, is there another way? If there's another way that we can pull this off, if there's another way we can show our love, if there's another way that we can bring people close, if there's another way, let's do it that way. But listen to his words. Yet not my will, but yours be done. What's Jesus saying right there? He's going, yes. Jesus loves his Father. He loves his Father. He loves us, but he loves his Father. And he's bowed before the Father, and with the weight of all that's to come on his shoulders and the ache that that brings, his answer is yes. Yes, Father, I'll go to the cross for them. And we always go, oh, that's because he loves us. I want to tell you, he's going to the cross because he loves his Father. And he will always be yes. Do you know why he loves his Father and why he can be yes? I know it's, you know, theologically because him and the Father are one and all that, but it's this. He knows the Father and he trusts the Father. So he says, Father, if this is what you want, I'm used to that. And he goes all the way to the cross. Think of that song. Not Percy singing this time, but maybe we're singing it. How would it go? When a person loves one God, they can't keep their mind on nothing else. They'll trade the world for the good thing they've found. When a person loves one God, they'll spend their very last dime trying to hold on to what they need. You know why? Because they've found out that they need him. They'd give up their comfort, they'd sleep out in the rain if God said that's the way it ought to be. When a person loves one God, they can never own or be owned by another. I like the idea of that. Just flick through to that last slide of the song, guys. When a person loves one God, they can do no wrong. They can never own or be owned by another. But it doesn't work, does it? Really? Like, do we ever do no wrong towards God? Even though we love him? Yeah, plenty. Do we ever be owned by another? Certainly by ourselves and our own lusts and desires and egos. Certainly by others or other things. So how does it work? How does it work? It's a great idea that I should be yes to God and that when Jesus would look at me, he would go, wow, I love your yes. I can see you love me. That would be cool, wouldn't it? Why is it not like that? I think a lot of it's to do with that thought that Jesus, he goes to the cross because he loves his Father, because he knows his Father, trusts his Father and his yes to his Father. My problem is that I don't know him well enough. I don't trust him like I should. I question his goodness. I question the fact that he has all things under his control. I struggle with that. And therefore, there's times when I pull back from being yes to him because I think, I'd have a better handle on this. And I trust myself, or I give in to others. And he's going, you look to me, know me, I love you, trust me, be yes to me. And yet we've got this image sometimes that he's this mean God who's going to, as soon as we step out of line, he's going to clip us. Or at best, he's the school teacher who's going to give us detention at least. And we forget the pictures that are repeated over and over in God's word of who God is to us. That he's the God who comes into the garden and he's going, Adam, Eve, where are you? I want to be with you. Why are you hiding? What happened? He's the father at the gate who goes out every day and he's looking and he's wondering, when will his son come home? And then one day he sees the son coming and he goes, you've got it coming? No, he doesn't. He runs to the son, embraces him. Says, welcome home. Our God is the one who, when men do their worst to him and they nail him to the cross, Jesus would cry out, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. See, that's our God. And if that's our God and we come to know him, we can trust him with our lives. And you know, all the stuff, and we're not even going into the stuff, where he calls on us to show compassion and kindness and to purify our lives and to abstain from some things and give our lives to other things. And there's all these instructions that we have in his word. And sometimes we're wrestling with them, aren't we? We're wrestling with, should I do that thing he's prompting me to do? Or do I really need to seek help to get rid of that habit that's destroying me or others? Like, and we hold back. And I think, why do we hold back? If he so loves us and so willingly waits, ready to embrace us, surely we would run to him and go, yes. And he would do the work in us. You see, I think this command to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, we can never do it. And it's almost the point of the command. You know what that command does? It's as it's to draw us to him. Go, God, I can't do this. I keep failing. I'm too often a no to you. And you go, I know that. That's why the cross. You are not yes to God. I'm not yes to God. But God would say, but my son Jesus is. And he was yes to me for you. And you just need to come. I'll do the loving. I'll do the loving. You come and you find yourself safe in my love, and I'll teach you how to love me. Your nature is towards being no. I'll teach you how to say yes. And then when you forget again or you fail again, come back again. And I've never stopped being yes to you, and I'll love you again. And I'll show you how to love and how to be yes. Maybe today you've never been yes to Jesus, and you could do that today. And maybe you've been it a dozen times and it's time to be there again. And I would just say today, let's just come in this next moment and be yes to him. Be yes to him. Just look at these questions here. These are questions that we're just every few weeks looking at. But I just look at that second question there. What might the Holy Spirit be saying to me today? And I guess to reword it would be, what is God asking you to be yes to today? And even if you feel like you can't do that, you can still come to him with that. What's he asking you to be yes to? It might be something he's wanting you to get rid of, something he's wanting you to do, relationship he wants you to end, or a relationship he wants you to restore. I don't know what he's asking of you. Maybe all he's asking of you today is to just come and let me love you. But what is he saying to you right now? And it's just in this moment, be yes to him. And if it's for the first time today, that you're just going, I never realized he loved me that much. Then I think today's a day where you can come and say, whether it's in your mind, in your thoughts, in your emotion, your heart, whether it's with words, it doesn't really matter. It's about your being. Coming, being like, Jesus, I want to be yes to you. I believe that you love me, that you gave your life for me. And I want my life to be yes for you. And he'll meet you there. Let's just pray.